explosion to his right, and he heard a scream. A moment later, a gleam on the ground caught his eye, and he spotted a tripwire. He was in a previously undetected minefield. A wave of pure panic swept over him as he realized that he might blow himself up with the next step. Then he got himself under control again. "Watch out underfoot!" he yelled, but his words were lost in the thunder of the guns. They ran on. The wounded had to be left for the medical teams, as always. A moment later, at 9:40, the guns stopped. Ludendorff had abandoned the old tactic of several days of artillery fire before an attack. It gave the enemy too much time to bring up reserves. 5 hours was calculated to be enough to confuse and demoralize the enemy without permitting him to reorganize. In theory, Walter thought. He straightened up and ran faster. He was breathing hard but steadily, hardly sweating, alert but calm. Contact with the enemy was now seconds away. He reached the British wire. It had not been destroyed, but there were gaps, and he led his men through. The company and platoon commanders ordered the men to spread out again, using gestures rather than words. They might be near enough to be heard. Now the fog was their friend, hiding them from the enemy, Walter thought with a little frisson of glee. At this point they might have expected to face the hell of machine gun fire, but the British could not see them. He came to an area where the ground had been completely churned up by German shells. At first he could see nothing but craters and mounds of earth. Then he saw a section of trench, and realized he had reached the British line. But it had been wrecked. The artillery had done a good job. Was there anyone in the trench? No shots had been fired, but it was best to make sure. Walter pulled a pin from a grenade and tossed it into the trench as a precaution. After it had exploded, he looked over the parapet. There were several men lying on the ground, none moving. Any who had not been killed earlier by the artillery had been finished off by the grenade. Lucky so far, Walter thought. Don't expect it to last. He ran along the line to check on the rest of his battalion. He saw half a dozen British soldiers surrendering, their hands on their steel soup bowl helmets, their weapons abandoned. They looked well fed by comparison with their German captors. Lieutenant von Braun was pointing his rifle at the captives, but Walter did not want his officers wasting time dealing with prisoners. He pulled off his gas mask. The British were not wearing them. "Keep moving!" he shouted in English. "That way, that way!" He pointed to the German lines. The British walked forward, eager to get away from the fighting and save their lives. "Let them go!" he shouted at von Braun. "Rear echelons will deal with them. You must keep advancing." That was the whole idea of stormtroopers. He ran on. For several hundred yards, the story was the same. Destroyed trenches, enemy casualties, no real resistance. Then he heard machine gun fire. A moment later he came upon a platoon that had taken cover in shell craters. He lay down beside the sergeant, a Bavarian called Schwab. "We can't see the emplacement," said Schwab. "We're shooting at the noise." Schwab had not understood the tactics. Stormtroopers were supposed to bypass strong points, leaving them to be mopped up by the following infantry. "Keep moving," Walter ordered him. "Go around the machine gun." When there was a pause in the firing, he stood up and gestured to the men. "Come on, up, up!" They obeyed. He led them away from the machine gun and across an empty trench. He ran into Gottfried again. The lieutenant had a tin of biscuits and was stuffing them into his mouth as he ran along. "Incredible!" he shouted. "You should see the British food!" Walter knocked the tin out of his hands. "You're here to fight, not eat, you damn fool!" he yelled. "Get going!" He was startled by something running over his foot. He saw a rabbit disappearing into the fog. No doubt the artillery had destroyed their warrens. He checked his compass to make sure he was still heading west. He did not know whether the trenches he was encountering might be communication or supply trenches, so their orientation did not tell him much. He knew that the British had followed the Germans in creating multiple lines of trenches. Having passed the first, he expected soon to come upon a well-defended trench they called the Red Line. Then, if he could break through that, another trench a mile or so farther west called the Brown Line. After that, there was nothing but open country, all the way to the west coast. Shells exploded in the mist ahead. Surely the British could not be responsible. They would be firing on their own defences. It must be the next wave of the German rolling barrage. He and his men were in danger of outstripping their own artillery. He turned. Fortunately, most of his people were behind him. He raised his arms. "Take cover!" he shouted, "Spread the word!" They hardly needed telling, having come to the same conclusion as he. They ran back a few yards and jumped into some empty trenches. Walter felt elated. This was going remarkably well. There were three British soldiers lying on the trench floor. Two were motionless, one groaning. Where were the rest? Perhaps they had fled. Alternatively, this might be a suicide squad left to defend an indefensible position in order to give their retreating comrades a better chance. One of the dead Brits was an unusually tall man with big hands and feet. Grunwald immediately removed the corpse's boots. "Nice size," he said to Walter by way of explanation. Walter did not have the heart to stop him. Grunwald's own boots had holes in them. He sat down to catch his breath. Reviewing the first phase in his mind, he could not think how it could have gone better. After an hour, the German guns fell silent again. Walter rallied the men and moved on. Halfway up a long slope, he heard voices. He held up a hand to halt the men near him. Ahead, someone said in English, "I can't see a fucking dicky bird." There was something familiar about the accent. Was it Australian? It sounded more like Indian. Another voice said in the same accent, "If they can't see you, they can't bloody shoot you." In a flash, Walter was transported back to 1914 and Fitz's big country house in Wales. This was how the servants there spoke. The men in front of him, here in this devastated French field, were Welsh. Up above, the sky seemed to brighten a little. 3. Sergeant Billy Williams peered into the fog. The artillery had stopped, mercifully, but that only meant the Germans were coming. What was he supposed to do? He had no orders. His platoon occupied a redoubt, a defensive post on a rise some distance behind the front line. In normal weather, their position commanded a wide view of a long, gradual downward slope to a pile of rubble that must once have been farm buildings. A trench linked them to other redoubts, now invisible. Orders normally came from the rear, but none had arrived today. The phone was dead, the line presumably cut by the barrage. The men stood or sat in the trench. They had come out of the dugout when the shelling stopped. Sometimes the field kitchen sent a wheeled cart with a great urn of hot tea along the trench at mid-morning, but there was no sign of refreshments today. They had eaten their iron rations for breakfast. The platoon had an American-designed Lewis light machine gun. It stood on the back wall of the trench, over the dugout. It was operated by 19-year-old George Barrow, the Borstal boy, a good soldier whose education was so poor he thought the last invader of England was called Norman the Conqueror. George was sitting behind his gun, protected from stray bullets by the steel breech assembly, smoking a pipe. They also had a Stokes mortar, a useful weapon that fired a 3-inch diameter bomb up to 800 yards. Corporal Johnny Ponty, brother of the Joey Ponty who died at the Somme, had become lethally proficient with this. Billy climbed up to the machine gun and stood beside George, but he could not see any farther. George said to him, "Billy, do other countries have empires like us?" "Aye," said Billy. "The French have most of North Africa. Then there's the Dutch East Indies, German Southwest Africa." "Oh," said George, somewhat deflated. "I heard that, but I didn't think it could be true." "Why not?" "Well, what right have they got to rule over other people?" "What right have we got to rule over Nigeria and Jamaica and India? Because we're British." Billy nodded. George Barrow, who evidently had never seen an atlas, felt superior to Descartes, Rembrandt, and Beethoven. And he was not unusual. They had all endured years of propaganda in school, telling them about every British military victory and none of the defeats. They were taught about democracy in London, not about tyranny in Cairo. When they learned about British justice, there was no mention of flogging in Australia, starvation in Ireland, or massacre in India. They learned that Catholics burned Protestants at the stake, and it came as a shock if they ever found out that Protestants did the same to Catholics whenever they got the chance. Few of them had a father like Billy's Da to tell them that the world depicted by their schoolteachers was a fantasy. But Billy had no time today to set George straight. He had other worries. The sky brightened a little, and it seemed to Billy that the fog might be clearing. Then, suddenly, it lifted completely. George said, "Bloody hell!" A split second later, Billy saw what had shocked him. A quarter of a mile away, coming up the slope toward him, were several hundred German soldiers. Billy jumped down into the trench. A number of men had spotted the enemy at the same time, and their surprised exclamations alerted the others. Billy looked through a slit in a steel panel set into the parapet. The Germans were slower to react, probably because the British in their trench were less conspicuous. One or two of them halted, but most came running on. A minute later, there was a crackle of rifle fire up and down the trench. Some of the Germans fell. The rest hurled themselves to the ground, seeking cover in shell holes and behind a few stunted bushes. Above Billy's head, the Lewis gun opened with a noise like a football supporter's rattle. After a minute, the Germans began to return fire. They appeared to have no machine guns or trench mortars, Billy noted gratefully. He heard one of his own men scream. A sharp-eyed German had spotted someone indiscreetly looking over the parapet, perhaps, or more likely, a lucky shooter had hit an unlucky British head. Tommy Griffiths appeared beside Billy. "Thy Paul got it," he said. "Wounded, dead, shot through the head." "Oh, bugger," said Billy. Mrs. Powell was a prodigious knitter who sent pullovers to her son in France. Who would she knit for now? "I've took his collection from his pocket," Tommy said. Di had a stack of pornographic postcards he had bought from a Frenchman. They showed plump girls with masses of pubic hair. Most of the men in the battalion had borrowed them at one time or another. "Why?" said Billy distractedly as he surveyed the enemy. "Don't want them sent home to Aberowen." "Oh, aye. What shall I do with them?" "Bloody hell, Tommy, ask me later, will you? I've got a few hundred fucking Germans to worry about at the moment." "Sorry, Bill." How many Germans were out there? Numbers were hard to estimate on the battlefield, but Billy thought he had seen at least 200, and presumably there were others out of sight. He guessed he was facing a battalion. His platoon of 40 men was hopelessly outnumbered. What was he supposed to do? He had not seen an officer for more than 24 hours. He was the senior man here. He was in charge. He needed a plan. He was long past getting angry about the incompetence of his superior officers. That was all part of the class system he had been brought up to despise. But on the rare occasions when the burden of command fell on him, he took little pleasure in it. Rather, he felt the weight of responsibility and the fear that he might make the wrong decisions and cause the deaths of his comrades. If the Germans attacked frontally, his platoon would be overwhelmed. But the enemy did not know how weak he was. Could he make it look as if he had more men? The thought of retreat crossed his mind, but soldiers were not supposed to run away the minute they were attacked. This was a defensive post, and he ought to try to hold it. He would stand and fight, at least for now. Once he had made that decision, others followed. "Give them another drum, George," he shouted. As the Lewis gun opened up, he ran along the trench. "Keep up a steady fire, boys," he said. "Make them think there's hundreds of us." He saw Di Powell's body lying on the ground, the blood already turning black around the hole in his head. Di was wearing one of his mother's jumpers under his uniform tunic. It was a hideous brown thing, but it had probably kept him warm. "Rest in peace, boyo," Billy murmured. Farther along the trench, he found Johnny Ponty. "Deploy that Stokes mortar, Johnny Bach," he said. "Make the buggers jump." "Right," said Johnny. He set up his two-legged gun mount on the floor of the trench. "What's the range? 500 yards? Johnny's partner was a pudding-faced boy called Suet Hewitt. He jumped up on the fire step and called back, "Aye, 500 to 600. Billy took a look for himself, but Suet and Johnny had worked together before, and he left the decision to them. "Two rings, then, at 45 degrees, said Johnny. The self-propelling bombs could be fitted with additional charges of propellant in rings to extend their range. Johnny jumped up on the fire step for another look at the Germans, then adjusted his aim. The other soldiers in the vicinity stood well to the side. Johnny dropped a bomb in the barrel. When it hit the bottom of the barrel, a firing pin ignited the propellant and it was fired. The bomb fell short and exploded some distance from the nearest enemy soldiers. 50 yards farther and a touch to your right," Seward shouted. Johnny made the adjustments and fired again. The second bomb landed in a shell hole where some Germans were sheltering. "That's it," shouted Suet. Billy could not see whether any of the enemy had been hit, but the firing was forcing them to keep their heads down. "Give them a dozen like that," he said. He came up behind Robin Mortimer, the cashiered officer, who was on the fire step shooting rhythmically. Mortimer stopped to reload and caught Billy's eye. "Get some more ammo, Taffy," he said. As always, his tone was surly, even when he was being helpful. "You don't want everyone to run out at the same time?" Billy nodded. "Good idea. Thanks." The ammunition store was 100 yards to the rear, along a communication trench. He picked out two recruits who could hardly shoot straight anyway. "Jenkins and Norsey, bring up more ammo, double quick!" The two lads hurried away. Billy took another look through the parapet peephole. As he did so, one of the Germans stood up. Billy guessed it might be their commanding officer about to launch an attack. His heart sank. They must have guessed they were up against no more than a few dozen men, and realized they could easily overwhelm them. But he was wrong. The officer gestured to rearward, then began to run downhill. His men followed suit. Billy's platoon cheered and fired wildly at the running men, bringing down a few more before they got out of range. The Germans reached the ruined farm buildings and took cover in the rubble. Billy could not help grinning. He had driven off a force 10 times the size of his own. "I should be a bloody general," he thought. "Hold your fire!" he shouted. "They're out of range!" Jenkins and Nosey reappeared, carrying ammunition boxes. "Keep going, lads," Billy said. "They may be back." But when he looked out again, he saw that the Germans had a different plan. They had split into two groups and were heading left and right away from the ruins. As Billy watched, they began to circle round his position, staying out of range. "Oh, bugger," he said. They were going to slip between his position and the neighbouring redoubts, then come at him from both sides. Or, alternatively, they might bypass him, leaving him to be mopped up by their rearguard. Either way, this position was going to fall to the enemy. "Take down the machine gun, George," Billy said. "And you, Johnny, dismantle the mortar. Pick up your stuff, everyone. We're falling back." They slung their rifles and backpacks, hurried to the nearest communication trench, and began to run. Billy looked into the dugout to make sure there was no one inside. He pulled the pin out of a grenade and threw it in, to deny any remaining supplies to the enemy. Then he followed his men into retreat. 4. At the end of the afternoon, Walter and his battalion were in possession of a rearward line of British trenches. He was weary but triumphant. The battalion had had a few fierce skirmishes but no sustained battle. The stormtroopers' tactics had worked even better than expected, thanks to the fog. They had wiped out weak opposition, bypassed strong points, and taken a great deal of ground. Walter found a dugout and ducked into it. Several of his men followed. The place had a homely look, as if the Brits had been living there for some months. There were magazine pictures nailed to the walls, a typewriter on an upturned box, cutlery and crockery in old cake tins, and even a blanket spread like a tablecloth on a stack of crates. Walter guessed this had been a battalion headquarters. His men immediately found the food. There were crackers, jam, cheese, and ham. He could not stop them eating, but he did forbid them to open any of the bottles of whiskey. They broke open a locked cupboard and found a jar of coffee, and one of the men made a small fire outside and brewed a pot. He gave Walter a cup, adding sweetened milk from a can. It tasted heavenly. Sergeant Schwab said, "I have read in the newspaper that the British were short of food, just as we are." He held up the tin of jam he was eating with a spoon. "Some shortage!" Walter had been wondering how long it would take them to work that out. He had long suspected the German authorities of exaggerating the effect of submarine war on Allied supplies. Now he knew the truth, and so did the men. Food was rationed in Britain, but the Brits did not look as if they were starving to death. The Germans did. He found a map carelessly left behind by the retreating forces. Comparing it with his own, he saw that he was not far from the Creuser Canal. That meant that in one day the Germans had taken back all the territory so painfully won by the Allies during the 5 months of the Battle of the Somme the year before last. Victory really was within the Germans' grasp. Walter sat down at the British typewriter and began to compose his report. Chapter 30. Late March and April 1918. Fitz held a house party at Tŷ Gwyn over the Easter weekend. He had an ulterior motive. The men he invited were as violently opposed as he was to the new regime in Russia. His star guest was Winston Churchill. Winston was a member of the Liberal Party and might have been expected to sympathize with the revolutionaries, but he was also the grandson of a duke, and he had an authoritarian streak. Fitz had long thought of him as a traitor to his class, but was now inclined to forgive him because his hatred of the Bolsheviks was passionate. Winston arrived on Good Friday. Fitz sent the Rolls-Royce to Aberowen Station to meet him. He came bouncing into the morning room, a small, slight figure with red hair and a pink complexion. There was rain on his boots. He wore a well-cut suit of wheat-coloured tweed and a bow tie the same blue as his eyes. He was 43, but there was still something boyish about him as he nodded to acquaintances and shook hands with guests he did not know. Looking around at the linen-fold panelling, the patterned wallpaper, the carved stone fireplace, and the dark oak furniture, he said, "Your house is decorated like the Palace of Westminster, Fitz." He had reason to be ebullient. He was back in the government. Lloyd George had made him Minister of Munitions. There was much talk about why the Prime Minister had brought back such a troublesome and unpredictable colleague, and the consensus was that he preferred to have Churchill inside the tent spitting out. "Your coal miners support the Bolsheviks," Winston said, half amused and half disgusted, as he sat down and stretched his wet boots to the roaring coal fire. "There were red flags flying from half the houses I passed." "They have no idea what they're cheering for," Fitz said with contempt. Beneath his scorn, he was deeply anxious. Winston accepted a cup of tea from Maud, and took a buttered muffin from a plate offered by a footman. "You've suffered a personal loss, I gather." "The peasants killed my brother-in-law, Prince Andrei, and his wife. I'm very sorry. Bayer and I happened to be there at the time, and escaped by the skin of our teeth." "So I heard. The villagers have taken over his land, a very large estate which is rightfully the inheritance of my son. And the new regime has endorsed such theft." "I'm afraid so. The first thing Lenin did was to pass his decree on land." Maud said, "In fairness, Lenin has also announced an 8-hour day for workers and universal free education for their children." Fitz was annoyed. Maud had no tact. This was not the moment to defend Lenin. But Winston was a match for her. "And a decree on the press which bans newspapers from opposing the government," he shot back. "So much for socialist freedom." "My son's birthright is not the only reason, or even the main reason, why I'm so concerned," Fitz said. "If the Bolsheviks get away with what they've done in Russia, where next? Welsh miners already believe the coal found deep underground doesn't really belong to the man who owns the land on the surface. You can hear the red flag sung in half the pubs in Wales on any given Saturday night. The Bolshevik regime should be strangled at birth," Winston said. He looked thoughtful. "Strangled at birth," he repeated, pleased with the expression. Fitz controlled his impatience. Sometimes Winston imagined he had devised a policy when all he had done was coin a phrase. "But we're doing nothing," Fitz said in exasperation. The gong sounded to tell everyone it was time to change for dinner. Fitz did not persist with the conversation. He had all weekend to make his point. On his way to his dressing room, it struck him that, contrary to custom, Boy had not been brought down to the morning room at tea time. Before changing, he walked down a long corridor to the nursery wing. Boy was now 3 years and 3 months old, no longer a baby or even a toddler, but a walking, talking boy with Bayer's blue eyes and blonde curls. He was sitting near the fire, wrapped in a blanket, and pretty young Nurse Jones was reading to him. The rightful lord of thousands of acres of Russian farmland was sucking his thumb. He did not jump up and run to Fitz as he normally would. "What's wrong with him?" Fitz said. "He's got a bad tummy, my lord." Nurse Jones reminded Fitz a bit of Ethel Williams, but she was not as bright. "Try to be more exact," Fitz said impatiently. "What is wrong with his stomach?" "He have got the diarrhea." "How the dickens did he get that?" "I don't know. The toilet on the train was not very clean." That made it Fitz's fault for dragging his family down to Wales for this house party. He suppressed a curse. "Have you summoned a doctor? Dr. Mortimer is on his way." Fitz told himself not to be so fretful. Children suffered minor infections all the time. How often had he himself had a bad tummy as a child? Yet children did sometimes die of gastroenteritis. He knelt in front of the sofa, bringing himself down to his son's level. "How's my little soldier?" Boy's tone was lethargic. "I got the trots." He must have picked up that vulgar expression from the servants. Indeed, there was the hint of a Welsh lilt in the way he said it. But Fitz decided not to make a fuss about that now. "The doctor will be here soon," he said. "He'll make you better."
"I don't want to bath."
"Perhaps you can skip your bath tonight." Fitz got up. "Send for me when the doctor arrives," he said to Nurse. "I'd like to speak to the fellow myself."
"Very good, my lord."
He left the nursery and went to his dressing room. His valet had laid out his evening clothes, with the diamond studs in the shirt front and the matching cufflinks in the sleeves, a clean linen handkerchief in the coat pocket, and one silk sock placed inside each patent leather shoe. Before getting changed, he went through to Bea's room. She was 8 months pregnant. He had not seen her in this state when she was expecting boy. He had left for France in August 1914, when she was only 4 or 5 months along, and he had not returned until after boy had been born. He had not previously witnessed this spectacular swelling, nor marvelled at the body's shocking ability to change and stretch. She was sitting at her dressing table, but not looking in the glass. She was leaning back, her legs apart, her hands resting on the bulge. Her eyes were closed, and she looked pale.
"I just can't get comfortable," she complained. "Standing, sitting, lying down, everything hurts.
You ought to go along to the nursery and take a look at boy."
"I will as soon as I can summon up the energy," she snapped. "I should never have travelled to the country. It's ridiculous for me to host a house party in this state."
Fitz knew she was right. "But we need the support of these men if we're to do anything about the Bolsheviks."
"Is boy's tummy still poorly?"
"Yes. The doctor is coming."
"You'd better send him to me while he's here. Not that a country doctor is likely to know much."
"I'll tell the staff. I take it you won't be coming down to dinner."
"How can I, when I feel like this?"
"I was just asking. Maud can sit at the head of the table." Fitz returned to his dressing room. Some men had abandoned tailcoats and white ties, and wore short tuxedo jackets and black ties at dinner, citing the war as their excuse. Fitz did not see the connection. Why should war oblige people to dress informally? He put on his evening clothes and went downstairs. 2. After dinner, as coffee was served in the drawing room, Winston said provocatively,
"So, Lady Maud, you women have got the vote at last."
"Some of us have," she said. Fitz knew she was disappointed that the bill had included only women over 30 who are householders, or the wives of householders. Fitz himself was angry that it had passed at all. Churchill went on mischievously,
"You must thank in part Lord Curzon here, who surprisingly abstained when the bill went to the House of Lords."
Earl Curzon was a brilliant man whose stiffly superior air was made worse by a metal corset he wore for his back. There was a rhyme about him. "I am George Nathaniel Curzon. I am a most superior person." He had been Viceroy of India, and was now leader of the House of Lords and one of the 5 members of the War Cabinet. He was also President of the League for Opposing Women's Suffrage, so his abstention had astonished the political world and severely disappointed the opponents of votes for women, not least Fitz.
"The bill had been passed by the House of Commons," Curzon said. "I felt we could not defy elected members of Parliament."
Fitz was still annoyed about this. "But the Lords exist to scrutinize the decisions of the Commons and to curb their excesses. Surely this was an exemplary case.
If we had voted down the bill, I believe the Commons would have taken umbrage and sent it back to us again."
Fitz shrugged. "We've had that kind of dispute before.
But unfortunately the Bryce Committee is sitting."
"Oh." Fitz had not thought of that. The Bryce Committee was considering the reform of the House of Lords. So that was it.
"They're due to report shortly. We can't afford a stand-up fight with the Commons before then."
"No." With great reluctance, Fitz had to concede the point. If the Lords made a serious attempt to defy the Commons, Bryce might recommend curbing the power of the upper chamber. We might have lost all our influence. Permanently.
That is precisely the calculation that led me to abstain.
Sometimes Fitz found politics depressing. Peel, the butler, brought Curzon a cup of coffee and murmured to Fitz,
"Dr. Mortimer is in the small study, my lord, awaiting your convenience."
Fitz had been worrying about boy's stomachache and welcomed the interruption.
"I'd better see him," said Fitz.
He excused himself and went out. The small study was furnished with pieces that did not fit anywhere else in the house. An uncomfortable Gothic carved chair, a Scottish landscape no one liked, and the head of a tiger Fitz's father had shot in India. Mortimer was a competent local physician, who had a rather too confident air, as if he thought his profession made him in some way the equal of an earl. However, he was polite enough.
"Good evening, my lord," he said. "Your son has a mild gastric infection which will most likely do him no harm."
"Most likely?"
I use the phrase deliberately.
Mortimer spoke with a Welsh accent that had been moderated by education.
"We scientists deal always in probabilities, never certainties. I tell your miners that they go down the pit every morning knowing there will probably be no explosion."
"Hmm."
That was not much comfort to Fitz. Did you see the princess?
I did. She too is not seriously ill. In fact, she is not ill at all, but she is giving birth.
Fitz leaped up.
What?
She thought she was 8 months pregnant, but she miscalculated. She is 9 months pregnant, and happily will not continue pregnant many more hours.
Who is with her?
Her servants are all around her. I have sent for a competent midwife, and I myself will attend the birth if you so wish.
This is my fault, Fitz said bitterly. I should not have persuaded her to leave London.
Perfectly healthy babies are born outside London every day.
Fitz had a feeling he was being mocked, but he ignored it. What if something should go wrong?
I know the reputation of your London doctor, Professor Rathbone. He is, of course, a physician of great distinction, but I think I can safely say that I have delivered more babies than he has.
Minors' babies.
Indeed, most of them, though at the moment of birth there is no apparent difference between them and the little aristocrats.
Fitz was being mocked.
I don't like your cheek, he said. Mortimer was not intimidated.
I don't like yours, he said.
You've made it clear, without even a semblance of courtesy, that you consider me inadequate to treat your family.
I would gladly take my leave.
He picked up his bag. Fitz sighed. This was a foolish quarrel. He was angry with the Bolsheviks, not with this touchy middle-class Welshman. Don't be a fool, man.
I try not to be.
Mortimer went to the door. Aren't you supposed to put the interests of your patients first?
Mortimer stopped at the door.
My God, you've got a bloody nerve, Fitzherbert.
Few people had ever talked to Fitz that way. But he suppressed the scathing retort that came to mind. It might take hours to find another doctor. Bayer would never forgive him if he let Mortimer leave in a huff.
I'll forget you said that, Fitz said.
In fact, I'll forget this whole conversation, if you will.
I suppose that's the nearest thing to an apology that I'm likely to get.
It was, but Fitz said nothing.
I'll go back upstairs, said the doctor.
3. Princess Bea did not give birth quietly. Her screams could be heard throughout the principal wing of the house, where her room was. Maud played piano rags very loudly, to entertain the guests and drown out the noise. But one piano rag was much like the next, and she gave up after 20 minutes. Some of the guests went to bed, but, as midnight struck, most of the men congregated in the billiard room. Peel offered cognac. Fitz gave Winston an El Rey del Mundo cigar from Cuba. While Winston was getting it alight, Fitz said, "The government must do something about the Bolsheviks." Winston glanced quickly around the room, as if to make sure that everyone present was completely trustworthy. Then he sat back in his chair and said,
"Here is the situation. The British Northern Squadron is already in Russian waters off Murmansk. In theory, their task is to make sure Russian ships there don't fall into German hands. We also have a small mission in Archangel. I'm pressing for troops to be landed at Murmansk. Longer term, this could be the core of a counter-revolutionary force in northern Russia."
"It's not enough," Fitz said immediately.
"I agree. I'd like us to send troops to Baku on the Caspian Sea to make sure those vast oil fields are not taken over by the Germans, or indeed the Turks, and to the Black Sea, where there is already the nucleus of an anti-Bolshevik resistance in the Ukraine. Finally, in Siberia, we have thousands of tons of supplies at Vladivostok, worth perhaps £1 billion, intended to support the Russians when they were our allies. We are entitled to send troops there to protect our property."
Fitz spoke half in doubt and half in hope.
"Will Lloyd George do any of this?"
"Not publicly," said Winston. "The problem is those red flags flying from miners' houses. There is in our country a great well of support for the Russian people and their revolution. And I understand why, much as I loathe Lenin and his crew. With all due respect to the family of Princess Bear."
He glanced up at the ceiling as another scream began.
"It cannot be denied that the Russian ruling class were slow to deal with their people's discontents."
Winston was an odd mix, Fitz thought. Aristocrat and man of the people. A brilliant administrator who could never resist meddling in other people's departments. A charmer who was disliked by most of his political colleagues. Fitz said, "The Russian revolutionaries are thieves and murderers."
"Indeed. But we have to live with the fact that not everyone sees them that way. So our Prime Minister cannot openly oppose the revolution."
"There's not much point in his opposing it in his mind," Fitz said impatiently.
"A certain amount may be done without his knowing about it, officially."
"I see." Fitz did not know whether that meant much. Maud came into the room. The men stood up, a bit startled. In a country house, women did not usually enter the billiard room. Maud ignored rules that did not suit her convenience. She came up to Fitz and kissed his cheek.
"Congratulations, dear Fitz," she said. "You have another son."
The men cheered and clapped and gathered around Fitz, slapping him on the back and shaking his hand. "Is my wife all right?" he asked Maud.
"Exhausted, but proud. Thank God.
Dr. Mortimer has left, but the midwife says you may go and see the baby now." Fitz went to the door. Winston said, "I'll walk up with you." As they left the room, Fitz heard Maud say, "Pour me some brandy, please, Peel." In a lowered voice, Winston said, "You've been to Russia, of course, and you speak the language." Fitz wondered where this was leading.
"A bit," he said. "Nothing to boast about, but I can make myself understood."
"Have you come across a chap called Mansfield Smith Cumming?"
"As it happens, I have. He runs..."
Fitz hesitated to mention the Secret Intelligence Service out loud. "He runs a special department. I've written a couple of reports for him."
"Ah, good. When you get back to town, you might have a word with him."
Now that was interesting. "I'll see him at any time, of course," said Fitz, trying not to show his eagerness.
"I'll ask him to get in touch. He may have another mission for you."
They were at the door to Bayer's rooms. From inside, there came the distinctive cry of a newborn baby. Fitz was ashamed to feel tears coming to his eyes.
"I'd better go in," he said. "Good night."
"Congratulations, and a good night to you, too."
4. They named him Andrew Alexander Murray Fitzherbert. He was a tiny scrap of life with a shock of hair as black as Fitz's. They took him to London wrapped in blankets, travelling in the Rolls-Royce with two other cars following in case of breakdowns. They stopped for breakfast in Chepstow and lunch in Oxford and reached their home in Mayfair in time for dinner. A few days later, on a mild April afternoon, Fitz walked along the embankment, looking at the muddy water of the River Thames, heading for a meeting with Mansfield Smith Cumming. The Secret Service had outgrown its flat in Victoria. The man called C had moved his expanding organization into a swanky Victorian building called Whitehall Court, on the river within sight of Big Ben. A private lift took Fitz to the top floor, where the spymaster occupied two apartments linked by a walkway on the roof.
"We've been watching Lenin for years," said C. "If we fail to depose him, he will be one of the worst tyrants the world has ever known."
"I believe you're right."
Fitz was relieved that C felt the same as he did about the Bolsheviks. "But what can we do?"
"Let's talk about what you might do."
C took from his desk a pair of steel dividers, such as were used for measuring distances on maps. As if absent-mindedly, he thrust the point into his left leg. Fitz was able to check the cry of shock that came to his lips. This was a test, of course. He recalled that C had a wooden leg as a result of a car crash. He smiled.
"A good trick," he said. "I almost fell for it."
C put down the dividers and looked hard at Fitz through his monocle.
"There is a Cossack leader in Siberia who has overthrown the local Bolshevik regime," he said. "I need to know if it's worth our while to support him."
Fitz was startled.
"Openly? Of course not. But I have secret funds. If we can sustain a kernel of counter-revolutionary government in the East, it will merit the expenditure of, say, £10,000 a month.
Name?
Captain Semenov. 28 years old. He's based in Manchuli, which lies astride the Chinese Eastern Railway near its junction with the Trans-Siberian Express.
So this Captain Semenov controls one railway line and could control another."
"Exactly. And he hates the Bolsheviks.
So we need to find out more about him, which is where you come in."
Fitz was delighted at the chance of helping overthrow Lenin. He thought of many questions. How was he to find Semenov? The man was a Cossack, and they were notorious for shooting first and asking questions later. Would he talk to Fitz or kill him? Of course, Semenov would claim he could defeat the Bolsheviks, but would Fitz be able to assess the reality? Was there any way to ensure he would be spending British money to good effect? The question he asked was, "Am I the right choice? Forgive me, but I'm a conspicuous figure, hardly anonymous even in Russia.
Frankly, we don't have a wide choice. We need someone fairly high level in case you get to the stage of negotiating with Semenov. And there aren't many thoroughly trustworthy men who speak Russian. Believe me, you're the best available."
"I see.
It will be dangerous, of course."
Fitz recalled the crowd of peasants battering Andrei to death. That could be him. He repressed a fearful shudder.
"I understand the danger," he said in a level voice. "So tell me, will you go to Vladivostok?"
Of course, said Fitz. Chapter 31 May to September 1918 Gus Dewar did not take easily to soldiering. He was a gangling, awkward figure, and he had trouble marching and saluting and stamping his feet the army way. As for exercise, he had not done physical jerks since his school days. His friends, who knew of his liking for flowers on the dining table and linen sheets on his bed, had felt the army would come as a terrible shock. Chuck Dixon, who went through officer training with him, said, Gus, at home you don't even run your own bath. But Gus survived. At the age of 11 he had been sent to boarding school, so it was nothing new to him to be persecuted by bullies and ordered about by stupid superiors. He suffered a certain amount of mockery because of his wealthy background and careful good manners, but he bore it patiently. In vigorous action, Chuck commented with surprise, Gus revealed a certain lanky grace, previously seen only on the tennis court. You look like a goddamn giraffe, Chuck said, but you run like one, too. Gus also did well at boxing because of his long reach, although his sergeant instructor told him, regretfully, that he lacked the killer instinct. Unfortunately, he turned out to be a terrible shot. He wanted to do well in the army, partly because he knew people thought he could not hack it. He needed to prove to them, and perhaps to himself, that he was no wimp. But he had another reason. He believed in what he was fighting for. President Wilson had made a speech to Congress and the Senate that had rung like a clarion around the world. He had called for nothing less than a new world order. A general association of nations must be formed under specific covenants for the purpose of affording mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small states alike. A League of Nations was a dream for Wilson, for Gus, and for many others, including, rather surprisingly, Sir Edward Grey, who had originated the idea while he was British Foreign Secretary. Wilson had set out his program in 14 points. He had spoken of reductions in armaments, the right of colonial people to a say in their own future, and freedom for the Balkan states, Poland, and the subject peoples of the Ottoman Empire. The speech had become known as Wilson's 14 points. Gus envied the men who had helped the president write it. In the old days, he would have had a hand in it himself. An evident principle runs through the whole program, Wilson had said. It is the principle of justice to all peoples and nationalities, and their right to live on equal terms of liberty and safety with one another, whether they be strong or weak. Tears had come to Gus's eyes when he had read these words. The people of the United States could act upon no other principle, Wilson had said. Was it really possible that the nations could settle their arguments without war? Paradoxically, that was something worth fighting for. Gus and Chuck and their machine gun battalion traveled from Hoboken, New Jersey, on the Corina, once a luxury liner, now converted to troop transport. The trip took 2 weeks. As second lieutenants, they shared a cabin on an upper deck. Although they had once been rivals for the affection of Olga Vyalov, they had become friends. The ship was part of a convoy with a Navy escort, and the voyage was uneventful, except that several men died of Spanish flu, a new illness that was sweeping the world. The food was poor. The men said the Germans had given up submarine warfare and now aimed to win by poisoning them. The Corinna waited a day and a half off Brest, on the northwest tip of France. They disembarked onto a dock crowded with men, vehicles and stores, noisy with shouted orders and revving engines, busy with impatient officers and sweating stevedores. Gus made the mistake of asking a sergeant on the dock what was the reason for the delay. "Delay, sir," he said, managing to make the word sir sound like an insult. "Yesterday we disembarked 5,000 men with their cars, guns, tents, and field kitchens, and transferred them to rail and road transport. Today we will disembark another 5,000 and the same tomorrow. There is no delay, sir. This is fucking fast." Chuck grinned at Gus and murmured, "That's told you." The stevedores were colored soldiers. Wherever black and white soldiers had to share facilities, there was trouble, usually caused by white recruits from the Deep South. So the army had given in. Rather than mix the races on the front line, the army assigned colored regiments to menial tasks in the rear. Gus knew that Negro soldiers complained bitterly about this. They wanted to fight for their country like everyone else. Most of the regiment went on from Brest by train. They were not given passenger carriages, but crammed into a cattle truck. Gus amused the men by translating the sign on the side of a rail car. 40 men or 8 horses. However, the machine gun battalion had its own vehicles, so Gus and Chuck went by road to their camp south of Paris. In the States, they had practiced trench warfare with wooden rifles, but now they had real weapons and ammunition. Gus and Chuck, as officers, had each been issued with a Colt M1911 semi-automatic pistol with a 7-round magazine in the grip. Before leaving the States, they had thrown away their Mountie-style hats and replaced them with more practical caps with a distinctive fore and aft ridge. They also had steel helmets the same soup bowl shape as the British. Now blue-coated French instructors trained them to fight in cooperation with heavy artillery, a skill the United States Army had not previously needed. Gus could speak French, so inevitably he was assigned to liaison duties. Relations between the two nationalities were good, though the French complained that the price of brandy went up as soon as the doughboys arrived. The German offensive had continued successful through April. Ludendorff had advanced so fast in Flanders that General Haig said the British had their backs to the wall, a phrase that sent shockwaves through the Americans. Gus was in no hurry to see action, but Chuck became impatient in the training camp. What were they doing, he wanted to know, rehearsing mock battles when they ought to be fighting real ones? The nearest section of German front was at the Champagne city of Reims, northeast of Paris. But Gus's commanding officer, Colonel Wagner, told him that Allied intelligence was confident there would be no German offensive in that sector. In that prediction, however, Allied intelligence was dead wrong. Two. Walter was jubilant. Casualties were high, but Ludendorff's strategy was working. The Germans were attacking where the enemy was weak, moving fast, leaving strong points behind to be mopped up later. Despite some clever defensive moves by General Foch, the new supreme commander of the Allied armies, the Germans were gaining territory faster than at any time since 1914. The biggest problem was that the advance was held up every time German troops overran stocks of food. They just stopped and ate, and Walter found it impossible to get them to move until they were full. It was the strangest thing to see men sitting on the ground, sucking raw eggs, stuffing their faces with cake and ham at the same time, or guzzling bottles of wine while shells landed around them and bullets whistled over their heads. He knew that other officers had the same experience. Some tried threatening the men with handguns, but even that would not persuade them to leave the food and run on. That aside, the spring offensive was a triumph. Walter and his men were exhausted after 4 years of war, but so were the French and British soldiers they encountered. After the Somme and Flanders, Ludendorff's third attack of 1918 was planned for the sector between Reims and Soissons. Here the Allies held a ridge called the Chemin des Dames, the Ladies' Way, so named because the road along it had been built for the daughters of Louis XV to visit a friend. The final deployment took place on Sunday, May 26th, a sunny day with a fresh northeasterly breeze. Once again Walter felt proud as he watched the columns of men marching to the front line, the thousands of guns being manoeuvred into position under harassing fire from French artillery, the telephone lines being laid from the command dugouts to the battery positions. Ludendorff's tactics remained the same. That night at 2 a.m., thousands of guns opened up, firing gas, shrapnel and explosives into the French lines on the summit of the ridge. Walter noticed with satisfaction that the French firing slackened off immediately, indicating that the German guns were hitting their targets. The barrage was short, in line with the new thinking, and at 5:40 a.m. it stopped. The stormtroopers advanced. The Germans were attacking uphill, but despite that they met little resistance, and to Walter's surprise and delight, he reached the road along the top of the ridge in less than an hour. It was now clear daylight, and he could see the French retreating all along the downhill slope. The stormtroopers followed at a steady speed, keeping pace with the rolling barrage of the artillery, but all the same they reached the River Ain, in the cleft of the valley, before midday. Some farmers had destroyed their reaping machines and burnt the early crops in their barns, but most had left in too much of a hurry, and there were rich rewards for the requisition parties in the rear of the German forces. To Walter's astonishment, the retreating French had not even blown up the bridges over the Ain. That suggested they were panicking. Walter's 500 men advanced across the next ridge during the afternoon and made camp on the far side of the River Velle, having advanced 12 miles in a single day. Next day they paused, waiting for reinforcements, but on the third day they advanced again, and on the fourth day, Thursday, May 30th, having gained an amazing 30 miles since Monday, they reached the north bank of the River Marne. Here, Walter recalled ominously, the German advance had been halted in 1914. He vowed it would not happen again. 3. Gus was with the American Expeditionary Force at the Chateau Villain training area south of Paris on May 30th, when the 3rd Division was ordered to help with the defense of the River Marne. Most of the division began to entrain, even though the battered French railway system might take several days to move them. However, Gus and Chuck and the machine gun set off by road immediately. Gus was excited and fearful. This was not like boxing, where there was a referee to enforce the rules and stop the fight if it got dangerous. How would he act when someone actually fired a weapon at him? Would he turn and run away? What would prevent him? He generally did the logical thing. Cars were as unreliable as trains, and numerous vehicles broke down or ran out of gas. In addition, they were delayed by civilians traveling in the opposite direction, fleeing the battle, some driving herds of cows, others with their possessions in handcarts and wheelbarrows. 17 machine guns arrived at the leafy small town of Château-Thierry, 50 miles east of Paris, at 6 p.m. on Friday. It was a pretty little place in the evening sunshine. It straddled the Marne, with 2 bridges linking the southern suburb with the northern town centre. The French held both banks, but the leading edge of the German advance had reached the northern city limits. Gus's battalion was ordered to set up its armament along the south bank, commanding the bridges. Their crews were equipped with M1914 Hotchkiss heavy machine guns, each mounted on a sturdy tripod, fed by articulated metal cartridge belts holding 250 rounds. They also had rifle grenades, fired at a 45-degree angle from a bipod, and a few trench mortars of the British Stokes pattern. As the sun set, Gus and Chuck were supervising the emplacement of their platoons between the 2 bridges. No training had prepared them to make these decisions. They just had to use their common sense. Gus picked a 3-story building with a shuttered cafe on the ground floor. He broke in through the back door and climbed the stairs. There was a clear view from an attic window across the river and along a northward leading street on the far side. He ordered a heavy machine gun squad to set up there. He waited for the sergeant to tell him that was a stupid idea, but the man nodded approval and set about the task. Gus placed 3 more machine guns in similar locations. Looking for suitable cover for mortars, he found a brick boathouse on the riverbank, but was not sure whether it was in his sector or Chuck's, so he went looking for his friend to check. He spotted Chuck 100 yards along the bank, near the east bridge, peering across the water through field glasses. He took 2 steps that way, then there was a terrific bang. He turned in the direction of the noise, and in the next second there were several more deafening crashes. He realized the German artillery had opened up when a shell burst in the river, sending up a plume of water. He looked again to where Chuck stood, just in time to see his friend disappear in an explosion of earth. "Jesus Christ," he said, and he ran toward the spot. Shells and mortars burst all along the south bank. The men threw themselves flat. Gus reached the place where he had last seen Chuck and looked around in bewilderment. He saw nothing but piles of earth and stone. Then he spotted an arm poking out from the rubble. He moved a stone aside and found, to his horror, that the arm was not attached to a body. Was it Chuck's arm? There had to be a way to tell, but Gus was too shocked to think how. He used the toe of his boot to push some loose earth aside ineffectually. Then he went down on his knees and began to dig with his hands. He saw a tan collar with a metal disc marked U.S., and he groaned. "Oh, God!" He quickly uncovered Chuck's face. There was no movement, no breath, no heartbeat. He tried to remember what he was supposed to do next. Whom should he contact about a death? Something had to be done with the body, but what? Normally you would summon an undertaker. He looked up to see a sergeant and 2 corporals staring at him. A mortar exploded on the street behind them, and they all ducked their heads reflexively, then looked at him again. They were waiting for his orders. He stood up abruptly, and some of the training came back. It was not his job to deal with dead comrades or even wounded ones. He was alive and well, and his duty was to fight. He felt a surge of irrational anger against the Germans who had killed Chuck. "Hell," he thought, "I'm going to fight back." He remembered what he had been doing, deploying the guns. He should get on with that. He would now have to take charge of Chuck's platoon as well. He pointed at the sergeant in charge of the mortars. "Forget the boathouse, it's too exposed," he said. He pointed across the street to a narrow alleyway between a winery and livery stables. Set up 3 mortars in that alley.
Yes, sir.
The sergeant hurried off. Gus looked along the street. See that flat roof, Corporal? Put a machine gun there.
Sir, pardon me. That's an automobile repair shop. There may be a fuel tank below.
Damn, you're right. Well spotted, Corporal. The tower of that church, then. Nothing but hymn books under that.
Yes, sir.
Much better. Thank you, sir. The rest of you follow me. We'll take cover while I figure out where to put everything else.
He led them across the road and down a side street. A narrow pathway or lane ran along the backs of the buildings. A shell landed in the yard of an establishment selling farm supplies, showering Gus with clouds of powdered fertilizer, as if to remind him that he was not out of range. He hurried along the lane, trying when he could to shelter from the barrage behind walls, barking orders at his NCOs, deploying his machine guns in the tallest and most solid-looking structures, and his mortars in the gardens between houses. Occasionally his subordinates made suggestions or disagreed with him. He listened, then made quick decisions. In no time, it was dark, making the job harder. The Germans sent a storm of ordnance across the town, much of it accurately aimed at the American position on the south bank. Several buildings were destroyed, making the waterfront street look like a mouthful of bad teeth. Gus lost 3 machine guns to shelling in the first few hours. It was midnight before he was able to return to battalion headquarters in a sewing machine factory a few streets south. Colonel Wagner was with his French opposite number, poring over a large-scale map of the town. Gus reported that all his guns and chucks were in position.
"Good work, Duer," said the colonel. "Are you all right?"
"Of course, sir," Gus said, puzzled and a bit offended, thinking the colonel might believe he did not have the nerve for this work.
"It's just that there's blood all over you."
"Is there?" Gus looked down and saw that there was indeed a good deal of congealed blood on the front of his uniform. "I wonder where that came from."
"From your face, by the look of it, you've got a nasty cut."
Gus felt his cheek and winced as his fingers touched raw flesh.
"I don't know when that happened," he said.
"Go along to the dressing station and get it cleaned up."
"It's nothing much, sir. I'd rather..."
"Do as you're told, Lieutenant. It will be serious if it gets infected."
The colonel gave a thin smile. "I don't want to lose you. You seem to have the makings of a useful officer." 4. At 4 o'clock the next morning, the Germans launched a gas barrage. Walter and his stormtroopers approached the northern edge of the town at sunrise, expecting the resistance from the French forces to be as weak as it had been for the past 2 months. They would have preferred to bypass Château Thierry, but it was not possible. The railway line to Paris went through the town, and there were 2 key bridges. It had to be taken. Farmhouses and fields gave way to cottages and small holdings, then to paved streets and gardens. As Walter came close to the first of the 2-story houses, a burst of machine gun fire came from an upper window, dotting the road at his feet like raindrops on a pond. He threw himself over a low fence into a vegetable patch and rolled until he found cover behind an apple tree. His men scattered likewise, all but 2 who fell in the road. One lay still, the other moaned in pain. Walter looked back and spotted Sergeant Schwab.
"Take 6 men, find the back entrance to that house, and destroy that machine gun emplacement," he said.
He located his lieutenants.
"Von Kessel, go west 1 block and enter the town from there. Von Braun, come east with me."
He kept off the streets and moved through alleys and backyards, but there were riflemen and machine gunners in about every 10th house. Something had happened to give the French back their fighting spirit, Walter realized with trepidation. All morning the stormtroopers fought from house to house, taking heavy casualties. This was not how they were supposed to operate, bleeding for every yard. They were trained to follow the line of least resistance, penetrate deep behind enemy lines, and disrupt communications, so that the forces at the front would become demoralized and leaderless, and would quickly surrender to follow-up infantry. But that tactic had now failed, and they were slogging it out hand to hand with an enemy who seemed to have gained his second wind. But they made progress, and at midday, Walter stood on the ruins of the medieval castle that gave its name to the town. The castle was at the top of a hill, and the town hall stood at its foot. From there, the main street ran in a straight line 250 yards to a double-arched road bridge across the Marne. To the east, 500 yards upriver, was the only other crossing, a railway bridge. He could see all that with the naked eye. He took out his field glasses and focused on the enemy positions on the south bank.
The men carelessly showed themselves, a sign that they were new to warfare. Veterans stayed out of sight. They were young and energetic and well-fed and well-dressed, he noted. Their uniforms were not blue but tan, he saw with dismay. They were Americans. 5. During the afternoon, the French fell back to the north bank of the river, and Gus was able to bring his armament to bear, directing mortar and machine gun fire over the heads of the French at the advancing Germans. The American gun sent a torrent of ammunition along the straight north-south avenues of Chateau Thierry, turning them into killing lanes. All the same, he could see the German advance fearlessly from bank to café, alley to shop doorway, overwhelming the French by sheer weight of numbers. As afternoon turned to bloody evening, Gus watched from a high window and saw the tattered remnants of the blue-coated French falling back toward the West Bridge. They made their last stand at the north end of the bridge and held it, while the red sun went down behind the hills to the west. Then, in the dusk, they retreated across the bridge. A small group of Germans saw what was happening and gave chase. Gus saw them run onto the bridge, barely visible in the twilight, grey moving on grey. Then the bridge exploded. The French had previously wired it for demolition, Gus realized. Bodies flew through the air and the northern arch of the bridge collapsed into a heap of rubble in the water. Then it went quiet. Gus lay down on a palliasse at headquarters and got some sleep, his first for almost 48 hours. He was awakened by the Germans' dawn barrage. Bleary-eyed, he hurried from the sewing machine factory to the waterfront. In the pearly light of a June morning, he saw that the Germans had occupied the entire north bank of the river and were shelling the American positions on the south bank at hellishly close range. He arranged for the crews, who had been up all night, to be relieved by men who had got some rest. Then he went from position to position, always staying behind the waterfront buildings. He suggested ways of improving cover, moving a gun to a smaller window, using sheets of corrugated tin to protect crews from flying debris, or piling up rubble either side of the gun. But the best way for his men to protect themselves was to make life impossible for the enemy gunners. "Give the bastards hell," he said. The men responded eagerly. The Hotchkiss fired 450 rounds per minute, and its range was 4,000 yards, so it was highly effective across the river. The Stokes mortar was less useful. Its up-and-over trajectory was intended for trench warfare, where line-of-sight fire was ineffective, but the rifle grenades were highly destructive at short range. The two sides pounded one another like bare-knuckle boxers fighting in a barrel. The noise of so much ammunition being fired was never less than deafening. Buildings collapsed, men screamed in the agony of wounds, blood-stained stretcher-bearers ran from the waterfront to the dressing station and back, and runners brought more ammunition and jugs of hot coffee to the weary soldiers manning the guns. As the day wore on, Gus noticed, in a back-of-the-mind way, that he was not scared. He did not think about it often. There was too much to do. For a brief moment, in the middle of the day, as he stood in the canteen of the sewing machine factory gulping down sweet, milky coffee instead of lunch, he marveled at the strange person he had become. Could it really be Gus Dewar who ran from one building to the next through an artillery barrage, shouting at his men to give 'em hell? This man had been afraid he would lose his nerve and turn around and walk away from the battle. In the event, he hardly thought of his own safety, being too preoccupied with the danger of his men. How had that come about? Then a corporal came to tell him that his squad had lost the special wrench used to change overheated Hotchkiss barrels, and he swallowed the rest of his coffee and ran to deal with the problem. He did suffer a moment of sadness that evening. It was dusk, and he happened to look out of a smashed kitchen window to the spot on the bank where Chuck Dixon had died. He no longer felt shocked by the way Chuck had disappeared in an explosion of earth. He had seen much more death and destruction in the last 3 days. What struck him now, with a different kind of shock, was the realization that one day he would have to speak about that awful moment to Chuck's parents, Albert and Emmeline, owners of a Buffalo bank, and to his young wife, Doris, who had been so against America's joining the war, probably because she feared exactly what had happened. What was Gus going to say to them? Chuck fought bravely. Chuck had not fought at all. He had died in the first minute of his first battle without firing a shot. It would hardly have mattered if he had been a coward. The result would have been the same. His life had just been wasted. As Gus stared at the spot, lost in thought. His eye was caught by movement on the railway bridge. His heart missed a beat. There were men coming onto the far end of the bridge. Their field grey uniforms were only just visible in the half-light. They ran awkwardly along the rails, stumbling on the sleepers and the gravel. Their helmets were of the coal scuttle shape, and they carried their rifles slung. They were German. Gus ran to the nearest machine gun emplacement behind a garden wall. The crew had not noticed the assault force. Gus tapped the gunner on the shoulder. "Fire at the bridge," he shouted. "Look, Germans!" The gunner swung the barrel around to the new target. Gus pointed to a soldier at random. "Run to headquarters and report an enemy incursion across the east bridge," he shouted. "Quick, quick!" He found a sergeant. "Make sure everyone is firing at the bridge," he said. "Go!" He headed west. Heavy machine guns could not be moved quickly. The Hotchkiss weighed 88 pounds with its tripod. But he told all the rifle grenadiers and mortar crews to move to new positions from which they could defend the bridge. The Germans began to be mown down, but they were determined and kept coming. Through his glasses, Gus saw a tall man in the uniform of a major who looked familiar. He wondered if it was someone he had met before the war. As Gus looked, the major took a hit and fell to the ground. The Germans were supported by a terrific barrage from their own artillery. It seemed as if every gun on the north bank had trained its sights on the south end of the railway bridge, where the defending Americans were clustered. Gus saw his men fall, one after another, but he replaced every killed or wounded gunner with a fresh man, and there was hardly a pause in the firing. The Germans stopped running and began to take up positions, using the scant cover of dead comrades. The boldest of them advanced, but there was no place to hide, and they were swiftly brought down. Darkness fell, but it made no difference. Firing continued at maximum on both sides. The enemy became vague shapes lit by flashes of gunfire and exploding shells. Gus moved some of the heavy machine guns to new positions, feeling almost certain this incursion was not a feint to cover a river crossing somewhere else. It was a stalemate, and at last the Germans began to retreat. Seeing stretcher parties on the bridge, Gus ordered his men to stop firing. In response, the German artillery went quiet. "Christ almighty," Gus said to no one in particular. "I think we've beaten them off." 6. An American bullet had broken Walter's shinbone. He lay on the railway line in agony, but he felt worse when he saw the men retreating and heard the guns fall silent. He knew then that he had failed. He screamed when he was lifted onto the stretcher. It was bad for the men's morale to hear the wounded cry out, but he could not help it. They bumped him along the track and through the town to the dressing station, where someone gave him morphine and he passed out. He woke up with his leg in a splint. He questioned everyone who passed his cot on the progress of the battle, but he got no details until Gottfried von Kessel came by to gloat over his wound. "The German army had given up trying to cross the Marne at Château Thierry," Gottfried told him. "Perhaps they would try elsewhere." Next day, just before he was put on a train home, he learned that the main body of the United States 3rd Division had arrived.